Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 13th, 2002. Today's session is titled The View, Conversations on Race and Gender, and it is presented by Stacy Kitahata, Andrea Walker, and Mary Pike. The number is KIS 2002-04. Let's listen in.
Called The View because of this TV show that I've never seen. But so we don't purport to be The View. We'll be our view, okay? So, and they probably don't do this either, which is start with prayer, but we'll do that this morning and then have a chance to meet all of you. The peace of God be with you all. Let's pray. Truly your peace is among us. Thank you for drawing us together this bright, fresh new morning. Thank you for drawing us together in the body of Christ to be your people, your leaven in the world. May we, through our conversation and love for one another, learn how to share and to live more faithfully so that we might truly be your people in ministry throughout the world. For this time, we give thanks for the presence of hearts and lives in this place, all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Welcome. Come on in. And you know, you could all sit in the first row too, so. Especially since, like, guys in the back and Gertrude. No, you can sit so you don't have to peek around.
Is anybody sitting upstairs?
No.
Nobody's sitting upstairs. And then there's these four nice padded seats over here.
Why don't we begin by introducing who you are, and then we'll introduce who you are. Oh, Jerry, we've started.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we go around the room introducing ourselves. Perhaps Michael could start.
I'm Michael Thomas, and I'm here on teaching staff with Susan for the past week and for this coming week, and we live in Jerusalem.
And I'm Michelle Friesen-Carper, and in my life outside of Holden, I'm an elementary school principal, and we have been here for the last 2 weeks serving as village musicians.
I'm Gloria Foster, and I probably have the shortest trip from Wenatchee.
Oh.
Besides being a mother, I'm an operating room nurse.
Wow. Ooh. Did you just come this yesterday?
No.
Okay, here, I'm sorry. Okay, she's all backlit, and I can't see her. I broke one of my contact lenses, so I'm having the impressionist Monet experience of Holden. The opposite thing, Dennis, of you, is I have to go like this.
I'm Susan Thomas, and I'm also living in Jerusalem and working there, and I'm very grateful for this time here.
I'm Sue Like. My husband Joe Bach was on teaching staff. He's gone. The remnant has stayed. And we live in Minneapolis area.
I'm David Evans. I'm an architect from Portland.
I'm Becky Evans, and I manage the apartment complex.
I'm Eve, and I'm from Tacoma, Washington, just on the other side, and I'm a reading teacher, and my family and I have come to Holden many times.
I'm Dennis. I belong to Michelle, and it's been a pleasure to be here for 2 weeks. We live in Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach at the university.
I'm Gertrude Ludwell. I'm from Rock Island, Illinois. And I've been here, I'm part of history because I've been here for 39 summers. Mm-hmm. And my husband was the first musician and started the whole music program. Mm-hmm. And I've been richly blessed to be here all these years and meet all these wonderful people.
Wow.
Also a retired teacher.
This morning we thought we would frame the question of why the three of us stay in a church or in churches or denominations that are predominantly white as women of color. So we will be discussing the issues of gender and race from that perspective of our own faith journey. Anderson Park, who's a theologian who teaches at United Seminary in Dayton, begins the latest book by saying, "All theology is biographical." So we want to start with our own biographies. English is my second language. Yeah, biographies. And weave that in to how we got to where we are now and what that means for our ministry. So who wants to start? Andrea.
Since they all look at me, and I'm a minority in this.
Your presence is bigger, though.
See, they do that to make me. So when they pick on me, I'll like acquiesce. I'm Andrea Walker, and I'm currently the pastor of St. John's Lutheran Church in the Bronx. And my story starts in Georgia. I have a 23-year-old son, and at the time that I noticed that there was a church up the hill from my apartment complex that I lived in, my son was about 6 or 7. And he had just spent the summer with my grandmother, his great grandmother, and she had taken him to church. And up until this time, I hadn't been a churchgoer. I hadn't been to church since I was about 13 or 14 years old. So my son comes back from his trip with my grandmother, and he says, he made this little Bible out of soap, and he says, "Mom, can we go to church?" And I was going through a particularly rough time in my life then. I was being separated from my first husband. And so I saw this church, and I walked up to the church. And it was an African-American Lutheran congregation. And at that time, I knew nothing about what Lutheran was, but began to be involved in this church. And every Sunday, I was there, every Sunday, because I remember things that my grandmother used to tell me about when you need God, God is there. And I had a good job at that time. I worked in a beauty salon, I was an electrologist, and I was making good money. I could take care of me and my son. And my grandmother always told me to give thanks. So that's another reason for going to the church, to give thanks and to take my son to church. So he really got involved in Sunday school, he had friends, and there was a community, and they began to take care of us. And that was my entry point into the Lutheran Church. Tell me when to stop.
Go ahead.
I became a Sunday school teacher. I was on the church council, began to be involved with the women's group, and it was a small congregation. I'd say they had about 100 families. One day, we're sitting around the table, and we're talking about planning a woman's service. So we're looking for, a personality to preach for the service. So they said, "Well, we call this person. And then we're just talking, and I'm the youngest person in the group. So I kind of go, "Well, it can't be that hard to get up and say what you know about God." And so they said, "Andrea, you do it." And I'm like, "Oh my God." And I like this church because, not only because it became a community, but for the first time, I understood everything the pastor was saying at Sunday. I began to understand what grace was, and that God loved me anyhow, and through Bible study and stuff like that. So I was like really excited. And that's why I said it can't be that hard to talk about God, because I felt this overwhelming sense of love, for God so loved the world. And can't be so hard to talk about that. So I did it with lots of prayer and a few books from the library on Women's Day. Everybody's singing and the church is packed, and it usually isn't packed. And I stood up, and I come from a Baptist Pentecostal tradition where women aren't preachers or pastors. So I would not stand in the pulpit. But I stood at the lectern and began to talk about women becoming and what that meant for me. And the tears started to come streaming down my face. And the whole congregation began to cry. And in that instant, I knew that that's what I was supposed to do. But it took me 4 or 5 years to be convinced, because I didn't have any college education. I was a single parent or anything like that. So it took me 4 or 5 years to realize that, well, seminary might be a place that I could go. So I went back to school and then went to seminary, and now I'm the pastor of St. John's Church. Wow.
Okay, I guess I missed. I was born in the city of Los Angeles, in the city, and grew up in South Central. So we were talking yesterday in our session about the rebellions that were happening in LA 10 years ago at the end of April. And the parking lot from which all the emergency vehicles and the whole operation was engineered was the grade school where I started kindergarten. So that it was right there in the heart of things. I was the oldest child, and then my brother was born, and then my mother had twins. So we had a big population explosion in our household. We were living in an apartment building that my mother's parents were managing. And so when my brother was born, we moved from the one-bedroom apartment to the two-bedroom apartment, and then all of us kids were in one bedroom. So then it was time to move again. And so from living in South Central in a building with my grandparents and then our family of six, we moved to Torrance, California, which was, when we moved there, we were the first non-white family to move into our block. And my grandparents moved as well. And they moved into the same town, but a different neighborhood across a big street. You know how it makes it a whole different neighborhood. And there were kids in there across the street from where my grandparents moved who were our same age. So they became our first friends. Now, both my mother and my father had grown up in families that were Buddhist. And my father's family was fairly devout. They had an altar in their home. My grandmother made regular offerings there and that sort of thing. My mother's family was more committed to becoming Americanized. So they were not as regular, they didn't have an altar in their home, they weren't as regular participants, but they still considered themselves. They sent my mother and her brothers and sisters to Catholic school. So my mother had been exposed to Christianity. They went to a Maryknoll mission school in Los Angeles that the Maryknolls had started in order to educate the Japanese children, the children of Japanese immigrants. So she was going to school with other Japanese American kids and had had a fairly positive experience of the discipline of the Maryknoll sisters. So when one of the kids from this family that we met invited my brother and me to join him in Sunday school, he and his mom came over to our house and knocked on the door and said, I would like to invite you to come to Sunday school. Then my mother was more than glad to let us go, and she thought this would be great. Quiet time on Sunday morning, and they're going to learn how to be nice, good, disciplined children like I learned in Catholic school. So it was wild. We had never been inside a church before. We didn't know what to expect or how to hold our hands when you pray or what exactly was going on when you were praying, who you were supposed to be talking to, all those kind of things. And it was all brand new to us, and fascinating because of that. And so this family who had Russell Bankson, who was my brother's age, who had invited us, really became sort of the introducers of our family into this community too, and which was a really, really nice thing. You know, Russell's mother tried to show my mother how to bake a lemon meringue pie and stuff like that, you know. Not that my mother, you know, she was born in the United States. She was pretty Americanized herself and whatever, but it was really nice, the kinds of little things that they did to help us into move into this community. But this congregation was Christ the King Lutheran Church in the town of Torrance. And it was the first time that I had spent that much time with white people. I was still a kid, but the contrast from the neighborhood in which we had grown up to this community and this church was really rather striking. In our family, on the first day of the new year, every New Year's Day, we would have a big meal, a big party, and my mother, because she was the oldest daughter, was responsible to spread out this meal. And there were particular foods that were set. There was one platter that always had the same foods in the same order. And then the table was spread, just like, you know, at Thanksgiving. It's not Thanksgiving if you don't have, right? And so this meal has all these Japanese foods and was all laid out on New Year's Day. Well, one of the things that we as young people in the church were invited to do, besides all setting up chairs for every event and all those kinds of things, right? Being the ushers on Youth Sunday or whatever it was, singing at the early service for Easter, because nobody in the choir wanted to get up at that early or whatever, that was something we always did, was to serve at the annual smorgasbord, which is still the first Saturday of December. This is like the one thing that happens every year. So I remember that, thinking that there are three sacraments in the Lutheran Church. That would be baptism, Eucharist, and smorgasbord. Because that's the only thing that happened at a regular day, at a regular time, and just like that meal in my mother's house, it was exactly the same foods on the same plates, in the same order, you know, and the goat cheese was next to the pickled herring, which was next to the krumkakas. Well, no, the krumkakas were on the dessert table. But anyway, so this whole thing, I just thought, okay, somehow this is a Christian ritual which connects us to God. And actually, in that congregation, it was, you know, because there are so many other things besides the official sacraments that are sacraments for us. But it was a warm and a nurturing place where I received my first Bible from this family. And the lessons that we heard and the stories were so interesting and amazing. And all of us wanted to know more. So we were very involved in the youth program and the ministry outside of worship. The only time we were in worship was when the youth choir had to sing or we had to usher. Otherwise, that was sort of really kind of the Holy of Holies, whatever happens in there. And the one time when, so then we had invited our friends too. And my cousin, who was my same age, lived in our community. And so she and I were involved together. And one time we were in worship because the youth choir was singing. And it happened to be one of those communion Sundays. What are the chances of that? Because at that point, the congregation was having communion only once a month. And so we went to the table. We came to the altar when communion was being offered. We knew what it was. We'd been going to Sunday school regularly. We understood the concept of it as much as anybody else, I'm sure. But as we were at the table, I don't even remember if we were served or not, actually, because it was, we knew that we were welcome there. And after the service, the pastor came up to us in coffee hour and said, would you like to come to the adult class and become members of this church and be baptized? No, actually, he didn't say the baptized part. And become members of this church? And we thought, we're not members of this church. We've been going here for a long, long time. And okay, I said we thought we knew what was happening at the rail. Clearly, if we thought smorgasbord was a sacrament, we didn't know everything. So we said, sure, we'll do an adult class, because we were doing everything because we were so fascinated by the whole thing. And it was my mother, when we asked our parents permission, then our mothers said, you know, becoming a member of this church means you will be baptized. And we knew that was a really, really big deal. And so she said, you think about it, and when you're 16, which was just, you know, a few months later, you can decide on your own. This is your choice and your decision. So with the summer, July 17th. So that's going to, is that today?
No.
No, it's next Wednesday. That's right. Was the day that my cousin and I were baptized together in this Lutheran church. And then following us, my brother then, my younger brother, and then my two sisters later, each of us as we were 16, which was my mother's arbitrary choice, chose to be members of this congregation, but also members of the body of Christ. And so that's how I came to be involved in the Christian church, and particularly as a Lutheran, because that summer we thought, now how is it that we're different from our Presbyterian friends, our Baptist friends, our Mormon friends, our Buddhist friends? So I checked a book out of the library, and it was called A Compendium of Luther's Theology. And I said this at my seminary exit interview, and Ken Sawyer, who was there as my faculty advisor person, says, "Oh, by so-and-so, it's on such and such a shelf," because he's the librarian at the seminary. I'm like, I'm gonna have to check. He actually did do that. Why don't you check it out? Because it's taken mythic proportions now. I don't know if you know this book, but it's clumped, Luther's writings of however many, 65 volumes, are clumped in little sections on baptism, you know, on the priesthood of all believers, and then there's little excerpts. And I just thought, this is so great. And I went into my pastor and said, how can we never talk about this in church? So it's been my process ever since, wondering about those things and what does it mean to be living out a Christian faith with some of those ideas and perspectives.
In 1884, Presbyterian and Methodist missionaries went to Korea and actually settled in the northern part of Korea. And when my, and there's this, you know, sort of a myth about who actually landed first, you know, whether it was the Presbyterian or the Methodist. Of course, we always say the Presbyterians. Yeah. And so when my grandfather was 8 years old in northernmost part of Korea, which is now part of North Korea, in a village called Shincheonju, which is where my family is from. When he was 8 years old, these missionaries just invited these kids to come to church, and he went, and he became a believer. And that's exactly the way he would just tell it. I went, and I became a believer. That was that. So that's where my Presbyterian roots go back to, North Korea. Not to Scotland, but to North Korea, where the American missionaries went and preached the good news. And there are funny stories about those missionaries, because when my grandmother, when she was in a Christian school, and the first time they were invited to have the banquet, she said all of her friends starved themselves all day because they were going to go to this banquet, a heavenly banquet, that night. Oh. And they got there. What is this? You know, why is it that Americans are so rich, but when they have banquets, it's just little pieces of bread and this sour tasting juice? So, stories about those times.
See, smorgasbord's better than
that's
that.
That's right. It was also during that time that Korea was annexed by Japan from 1910 to 1945. I'm not going to say for 36 years your people oppressed my people. Okay, I'm not going to say that. But for 36 years, they couldn't speak Korean in public, and they were given new names, Japanese names, and so my father's family name was Shirakawa, which means white river, and my mother's family name was Natsuyama, which is summer mountain, which I didn't find out until the last couple of years ago, because it was something that they could not talk about, to even conjure up the memory of their names. So both my parents' families, they're from North Korea and became Presbyterians. And so 1945, we dropped the bomb in Japan. Japan surrenders. Japan leaves Korea. You can't just leave this peninsula empty. So the Russians take half, and the U.S. takes half, and there's a divided 38th parallel line, right? Which still exists, the only divided country still. So then at that time, just before 1945, during the Japanese occupation, my grandfather, who had been a leader in the church, was being persecuted, and so he moved his family to South Korea, where he was not known as a leader. My mother's family still was in North Korea. Right after 1945, then my mother's family then had to escape communist North Korea. So the family all split up, and my mother and her older sister and her younger brother, my mother was in 1945, she was 11, had to kind of dress up as a fisherman's family and sneak out and row the boat all the way out into the Yellow Sea and then come back in to South Korea. And so then they had this plan, well, when you go there, we'll just meet at so-and-so's house. And so then they kept waiting for their father, my grandfather, because he kept getting arrested. So that took a long time for the whole family to come together. In November of 1945, my father's family, then who had been in South Korea for a couple of years, they were receiving all these refugees from North Korea, and they said, we need to start a church for these North Korean refugees. And so on the last Sunday of November of 1945 was when they set a tent and said, we're gonna start it today. And 27 people gathered to worship on that day. And that is now the largest Presbyterian church in the world. So that's how my grandfather's sort of legacy lives on. The sad part about that is that the church is so wealthy now that it sometimes forgets its roots about how they began as a church for refugees. But anyway, so that's one part of my story. And then the other part is that when we were born into this Presbyterian family. I was always part of a church. I don't remember any time when I was not always going to church or praying or doing something in church. But my parents had a weird theology, or, you know, theologies kind of get mixed up when they cross oceans, I think. So they had sort of a Baptist theology with a Presbyterian polity. So they had elders and things, but, you know, infant baptism was just a little, not quite sure. So we were not baptized at that time. But we went to church every Sunday, very involved with Sunday school and children's choirs and all that stuff. And I always had a very, very, very close feeling to God, because I thought God is here, you know, and I'm so close. All of the biblical stories were like my stories and so on. And then it wasn't until 1969 that my family moved to the United States that I began questioning all those stories. So in 1969, the immigration law changed in 1965-67, so then we could immigrate to the United States. So my family, we land at LAX, get driven to Altadena, California, and we go to church. And I'm experiencing church differently, because this God that I thought was so close, who spoke Korean, somehow in church was all different. And it was being talked about in a very, very different way. And the other thing was that at that time, I didn't speak any English. And so all of my prayers were in Korean. And so as I began learning English, I would still pray in Korean, and then there came a time where I kept losing Korean. so that I lost the ability to pray. And so it was so interesting that coming to this place that is sort of the one nation under God, that I would lose that relationship with God. In my early years, from when I was 11 to when I went to college, I was a member of a Korean congregation where my parents were members. And because they didn't have a church building, then they nested in a white congregation. So this was in Sacramento, California. And so I had sort of a dual membership in both congregations. Well, I would play the piano for the Korean congregation, and then I would go to Sunday school and youth group in the white congregation. And so it was always sort of back and forth. And that sort of has been the theme of my life in the Presbyterian Church, always having sort of one foot in this Korean community and one foot outside of the Korean community. I went to San Francisco Theological Seminary and was ordained and served a Korean American congregation for 5 years, being the English speaking pastor for second and third generation Korean Americans who only speak English. And that was a rich experience, that was the real calling that I had received and that first began to grow in me about what ministry could be like. At this point, I'm going to segue into to sort of the joys and sorrows then of being a part of a denomination that is predominantly white. And that'll be the next question. One of the, so because I'm third generation Presbyterian and my grandmother, have this whole legacy, in some ways I think that I'm as Presbyterian as I can get. You know, I am thoroughly Presbyterian. There is not a bone in my body that's not Presbyterian. And I am more Presbyterian than most people I know. So it was last year. It was at Jed's ordination. It was a year and a half ago. I was invited to preach at the ordination of one of our former students, who received a call to be the associate pastor of a Presbyterian church in Larchmont, New York, Westchester County. Do you all know anything about Westchester County? That's where people live to commute into Manhattan. And so, very, very wealthy community. And so I was invited to preach there. And so I'm sitting there and thinking, well, hey, this is a Presbyterian church. I should be feeling at home. And just like that, I looked around and I thought, who are these people? Who are these people? And all of a sudden, I started saying, these are not my people. Who are these people? I don't belong here. And they know that I don't belong here. And I think that is sort of at the bottom of my sorrow about being in a denomination that is predominantly white, is that as Presbyterian as I am, it's not home. And as much as I want it to be home, it's not completely home. And even if I wanted to be home, others still see me as that Presbyterian. There's always sort of a question about whether I belong there or not. And the flip side of being a part of this denomination is that, because I do have a choice, there's a Korean Presbyterian Church in America, which is just all Koreans, and it's in the United States, it's a whole different denomination. The reason I can't be part of that denomination is on the issues of a theology about women's place in the church and other issues of justice. So that the joy about being a part of a denomination that has the resources, that is forward-looking, that is global, is that it affords me a place where I can contribute and also a place where I can really learn and gain from. So those two things, our intention, are in concert at times, and I'm in those places. How about neither of you?
I have some of the same joys and the same sorrows as Mary does, coming from a different place, because my background is Baptist and Pentecostal. But I was always a very reserved child, and I stuttered for years. And the excitement and the energy that was in Baptist and Pentecostal churches, and the limits that were placed on people in those churches, never quite did anything for me. And that's probably why I didn't go to church for years. And like I said, in the Lutheran church, for the first time, I met a God that was loving and giving and took all the limits and boundaries off my life. I grew up pretty poor. My mother was a single parent. And for the first time, belonging to this Lutheran church, people start talking to me about possibilities and opportunities and things that I could do. And the limits and the boundaries just lifted off my life. And I think I found myself in the Lutheran church. Grace made sense to me. And that's one of the joys. God found me, because we don't find God, but this excitement and this overwhelming sense of being loved and being capable and not being limited, that's my greatest joy in the Lutheran church. And as I said, I've since gotten an education and become a pastor. Now, walking into the Lutheran church, I had no idea that this was a white church. You know, it was church. And so I began to understand that this was a white church and that I was stranger or other anytime I went out of my local congregation or the local black churches. And I began to work for the Lutheran Theological Center in Atlanta, where I did youth ministry and coordinated programs and leadership conferences for the African-American community. But other part of my role was sitting in board meetings of Southern and Trinity Seminary, just because I was a member of the staff of LTCA. And that's my real sense of other. And people would turn around and look at me and go, well, what is she here for? And she doesn't belong here. And then I began to have the role of defending the black cause or being the example of African-American Lutherans. Mm-hmm. And that becomes really, really exhausting. Mm-hmm. Really exhausting. And an example of that is my boss, Dr. Carl Ficken, who became like a father for me, professor at Southern for many years, ran the center for many years. We're sitting at a meeting and this issue comes up and I'm exhausted. I work another job, I have a child to raise, and I'm sitting there and this issue comes up and I don't say a word, but I'm supposed to be defending the cause. So he looks at me and challenges me to defend the cause, and I kind of turn and just look at him. Because at that minute, at that time, in that instant, all I wanted to do was sit there, mm-hmm. because I was tired. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't have the luxury mm-hmm. of doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm always mm-hmm. have to give myself and always have to be in a teaching mode when I'm outside of the African American community in the Lutheran church. Mm-hmm. And that can be really, really tiring. And that's a sorrow.
Aren't they interesting people?
Mm-hmm.
When our family moved into this community, it was really the beginning of the diversification of this part of Southern California. And you know the story of California. There's no majority culture there, and there hasn't been for the last 5 years. And so the community that, the high school that I went to was quite diverse, not so many African American people, but Latinos and many types of Asians. Now when you look at the picture of the high school class, you know, it's like, where is this? And so the young people that I was involved in church with were fairly diverse, more diverse than the rest of the congregation. And lots of Asians in my high school. So we were all on the same track of the do really, really well, get into a good school, fulfill your parents' hopes and expectations that you will achieve a higher standard of acceptance within this society and a level of education that wasn't attainable to them. Lots of Japanese Americans in our community. It was about 15% of my high school. I was the first person to graduate from college in my family because my parents, my mother graduated from high school in camp during World War II, and my father's family left camp. He was the youngest child, and he graduated after a year of high school in Chicago. And so they didn't, college had been an option before, but that had evaporated as a viable option for them because of the time of history in which they were living. So a lot of responsibility, expectations placed on me and fulfilling this educational goal. So I graduate from UCLA having changed my major from pre-med biology to psych the last year of that. And I actually didn't tell my parents until graduation. At this point would be the major disappointment of my entire life, right? Because so I actually told my mother, Mom, at graduation, I won't be sitting in this section. I'll be sitting in this section. So it'd be good if you were sitting on this part of the graduation ceremony. Why is that? And they were pretty, you know, okay, whatever you want to do with your life, you just do the best, you know, but, because they knew that was what they were supposed to say. So I had an on-campus job, and so I continued doing that after graduation, wondering, what in the heck am I going to do with a psych major and 4 years of biology and physics and chemistry and everything else? And it was one Sunday after church at coffee hour. Okay, it's California, so coffee hour is outside, you know. And up on the bulletin board outside, she says, did you see that there's a job posted for Lutheran Social Services? And it sounds like something you could do, because I had done a lot of kind of stuff at college with the community. And so she says, except, it says that resumes are due tomorrow. So I went over to church and I made a resume.
Sounds like a
and I faxed it off to LSS. And so I my first full-time job was with Lutheran Social Services doing emergency assistance, direct service, welfare advocacy, housing, and those kind of things in the city of Los Angeles. So returning back to the city and to some of the neighborhoods where I had grown up. And that was my experience of what it meant to be church. I received from this congregation a real hands-on experience of ministry, that we make a difference in the lives of people at their most vulnerable felt need. And at that point in the church in Southern California, Gaylord Faldi was retiring as bishop, and Nelson Trout, the first African-American bishop in the Lutheran Church in North America, became our bishop. So it was an exciting and vibrant time to be a Lutheran Christian for me. And Barb and I have taught a class together at LSTC, at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and it's introducing theologies from many perspectives. And in that, Barbara says something about herself, about having come to embrace liberation theology and liberating paradigms for theologizing as her own. And I realized one day, sitting in class, Unity and Diversity, as we were doing our introductions, I thought, that is, it's not as though I learned some theology and then introduced to liberation theology, but through the teaching of Nelson Trout, through the stuff that was happening in the church in those days, that was the theology that's how I met God. That's the way that I understand the way God engaged us and the world. And so, and that was what I was about in my life and work while I was in Southern California. I worked for LSS, I did employment development, I worked for the Hunger Program related to the, you know, the predecessor church body. And so when the ELCA came into being, we were all part of that vision of a whole and inclusive and participatory, you know, engaging church. And there was a woman here who's been here the last week that she and I knew each other from those days. And there was a woman who lived in Arizona who did governmental advocacy, a woman in Sacramento who worked with Virginia. Both of them were African-American women. We had a number of African-American pastors in Los Angeles because Nelson Trout had been teaching at Trinity Seminary in Columbus and had, you know, made a space for these guys, Ken Wheeler and Al Starr and these other guys to. I actually naively thought that the Lutheran Church had a historically black seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Because every pastor I knew from that seminary was black. So I just thought it was like Morehouse or Spelman or something. No, you could ask Ben Stewart. He went to that seminary. It's not. But anyway, and so then Sarah and Ruby and I, the two African-American women that I worked with, and I thought, you know, isn't this so exciting? And we thought, they're looking for women, for people of color to work at the church-wide office. Wouldn't that be cool? And then we looked at each other like, we live in California and in Arizona. Why would we want to go to Chicago? And so then we said, forget it. And then, of course, the church came looking for us because they really were looking for women and people of color. And I had several invitations to consider positions. And one was with the Division for Global Mission at the ELCA, which I then accepted in doing global education, which followed in that liberation vein and expanded the perspective beyond even our own borders, but to the entire world, and how is it that these same liberating paradigms, we can be part of expanding and exploring and living them out. But it was, that's right. And those of us who were people of color who came to work at the church-wide office, that was wild. In those first days of the ELCA, we were poster children for the new church. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to just talk for the black experience in Atlanta. It was like, what do Asians think about that? like all 1.5 billion of them, you know, or whatever. And what that was like, trying to, and all so many well-meaning people. And when, so I did that task working at the ELCA in Global Mission for 9 years. I started seminary during that time. Didn't want to go to a denominational seminary in Chicago, but did that because that was the seminary that was there. And then worked at the seminary for 4 years and then have come back west. And in the process of coming back west and interviewing for a position where my job is multicultural ministry, we were talking about this question. When you look out, does it feel like your church? Do you look at those people and say, this is my church? And I wrote that in my little application for this position because I look out and I see Swedes and Norwegians and Finns and Danes and Germans and then Ben Sakamoto and I think, or Miguel's mom, Roseanne, and think, this is my church. I know that, but you don't know that.
Yes.
Because, and I love you, and you have no clue that your church has Tanzanians and Zimbabweans and Indonesian peoples of several different groups and, you know, all these other peoples that you don't even know exist in the world. We are church together, and I have a burden for that. That's my sorrow. that people in our congregations don't know that they are already a part of a multicultural global church, that they're not living out that experience, and that it's painful for me that that's frightening for so many people, and that it's threatening for so many people, when for me that's really, if we're not church in that way, then we're not church. And so the vision that for God's wholeness was a gift from the Lutheran Christian faith to me, but it's that same vision that I ache and yearn for the church in this context to really know and embrace.
And I think that's probably why I stay in the church, because where I met Stacy was on being picked to be part of Lift Every Voice, which was a multicultural speakers bureau. And there were four representatives from every community in the church.
Hispanics, youth and young adults.
Young adults, youth and young adults. I was kind of a little older than that, but Native Americans, Latinos, African Americans, whites, differently able. Did I miss anybody? Everybody, we were all there. And I remember the experience, and Stacy was one of the trainers for this. We were coming together in a bank after our training was over in Chicago in this room. And all of us were there. And we were all getting up. We spoke for 3 minutes, each of us that were part of the Speakers Bureau, about our vision or what this meant for us. And we're sitting there, and this feeling of, this is what mm-hmm. the church is. Mm-hmm. I experienced that in this room with people from all these communities. This is what the church is. And that's why I stay in the Lutheran church, because in the Lutheran church, the possibility for the kingdom of God, for church to really be what church is, exists. And I'm staying here in this church to help that vision.
And I've said sort of the flip side of that, which is in my angry moments, I'll say, without me, your church would be a heresy. Right? Without me, the Presbyterian church, all the white Presbyterian church, a white denomination in this day and age in the United States, is a heresy. So I think we stop here and open up for conversation. Becky?
I was asking us to go out and draw more people of color into our community, into our churches. Are you asking us to go out
evangelize?
Oh, that's a novel idea.
Well, the average Lutheran invites someone to church once every 23 years. So the fact that I was invited by church, he totally was taken care of for his lifetime, you know.
are you subtly trying to say that?
Subtly?
Well, that's part of it. But what does it mean for you?
My community that I live in, my morning to night, 24/7 is white people.
Is part of
it? We are gay and lesbian and black and every color. Mm-hmm. And many years ago, one of David's clients said to him, David, there isn't a day that goes by that I'm not reminded that I'm black. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel in my community that there isn't a day that goes by that I'm not reminded that I'm white. Mm-hmm. And it's tiring because I want to talk mm-hmm. about carrot seeds. You know, I want to talk about, in New York, have you found a radish that doesn't bolt? You know, I don't want to talk about race issues. I'm tired mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And that's
you all
really
that's your role this week to talk about.
Yes,
this.
That's exactly.
So we're sort of stuck with talking
about.
But
every day we wake up thinking, okay, I'm Korean American, I'm a person of color. All of these things, you know, it's just assumed because of the way I look. Okay, and then we get up. But because what you say about being conscious of being white is not. But some of you don't have to think that. You can just go through your life not really thinking about your whiteness. We don't have the luxury of not thinking about it. And so really, if you were to ask what I wanted, is I want conversion. I want a conversion of the heart that says, how do I sit at an equal place with people of color? How do I recognize my privilege as a white person? And what does that mean? And how do I use that privilege to build a more just world and not a world that one dominates over the other? And so it really is a conversion that I would see. And for us too, and for all people of color. And as we were talking about yesterday, because we all benefit from whiteness.
Exactly.
Because I can play white really well. Because, especially for Asian Americans, you know, we're quieter.
We're not
we
as threatening.
We can slide by, we can especially sort of fake women. It. And I could probably serve a large white church, maybe as an associate pastor, would do that. But there's cost to that. You know, and so it's a choice for us as well.
Well, I was just going to say that Mary refers to whiteness, and yesterday in our workshop that Dave and Becky were part of, we differentiated between white as a racial category, skin tone, whatever, and whiteness as a systemic, dynamic interrelationship of race, gender, sexual preference, and class. Okay?
And
age. We said that age was kind of an overlay. But that's race, gender, sexual preference, and class. And that is a paradigm. There is a paradigm of whiteness that is the epitome that we are to achieving, right, in each of those categories. And so if we want to pass in some of those areas, as we do in our general life, because we're college-educated people, you know, that's sort of giving us a little movement in there, or achieving a sort of class rank, but then in the areas of race and gender, and as heterosexual people, but in the areas of race and gender, then that's the areas that we're wrestling with.
And, you know, we didn't talk much about the gender issue. And part of the joys of being in this Lutheran church is being able to be a pastor.
Right.
Because in many denominations in my tradition, and the African-American community in the tradition, you can be a minister, but, you know, there's not a whole lot of pastors in Baptist and Pentecostal traditions. And so part of that joy is being able to be a pastor in the Lutheran church. But then part of that is still that when I walk in somewhere, even if I'm in a room full of white women pastors, I'm still black.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like this double thing that I have to always be conscious of, as you know, if I walk into a room with all black male pastors, then I'm a woman and I don't exactly fit. But then if I walk in a room with all white women pastors, I'm a woman, but I'm black, so I don't actually fit. So sometimes, some days I spend thinking, where is my place? And, you know, this is where I find my place lots of times. You know, even though they gang up on me, though. this is my place.
So, Becky, when you ask, are we asking you to get more people of color in the church? Before that, what is it you're inviting people to? And who are we as church? Who are we when we're getting together? Because, you know, all those guys, those pastors that you get invited to be with, you know, if you have to take a deep breath to go there, you know, why is that? What is it that you're getting invited to? And each of us need to ask. that? And how do we create a place that where the priorities aren't on the color of your skin,
or
your gender, or your sexual orientation, or your class, which is how most of our congregations, whatever race they are sort of organized, because we bought into this paradigm in our U.S. American society. So if we are a community of God's vision, then it's the other side of that, right? And where all people are welcome and feel the space is created for them to be whole and fully themselves. And that includes the poor folk. And the, you know, for Lutherans, that means like lower middle class folk, working people, people who labor, you know, and gay and bisexual and transgendered persons who feel a safe place for who they are, for women and for children, we talked about age, and for elders.
One thing that in a way, I thought that each of you provided an answer. You all said that you were invited, and how being invited changed each of your lives. And when you said that, I began thinking of my own life and how I think I'm planning everything out, but how much of my life has been shaped by people inviting me to do something. And there has to be some, maybe this is the three wise women here who are offering an answer about inviting, but that's a very powerful effect on our lives. Becky and I took this sort of life planning, spiritual directing thing yesterday where you mapped out your life a little bit. And it hadn't occurred to me at that time how many of the positions that happened in my life had been by invitation. Interesting.
Sure.
Well, in our community, the minority is largely Hispanic because of the migrant worker population. And though it was rather controversial because of the gay issue at the time, my husband started a Boy Scout troop and asked our congregation to provide the space for it and to support them. And it was a choice that was made consciously, even recognizing that we didn't agree with everything with Scouts, but it was the best we had to offer to the Hispanic community. And mainly because there, a lot of them are, you know, first generation here, they don't allow their daughters to go out the same way they do their boys. So taking it a step at a time, we started this Boy Scout troop, and we now in that Scout troop have about 6 white boys and anywhere from 20 to 30 Hispanic boys. And it's it evolved. First they come to our house for dinner, and it started with just 2 little kids coming home for dinner, and the next thing I knew we had this, you know, all these kids, and that seemed to be a big part of it. And it was fine, we can do that. We have a rec room that we can do that in. But it has been an amazing ministry, and we're taking it rather slow. But they meet every Tuesday night at our church group. But we do encounter some obstacles, and now I need to go back and really address it more than just say, hey, by the way. There are a few people on our YES team, Youth and Education Services team, of which I'm a part, that manage to schedule youth events on Tuesday night when the Scouts meet. And the first time they did, I assumed it was an accident, so I mentioned it. The second time they did, I thought, this is funny. I'll mention it again, and now I see in our that there's something else scheduled for a Tuesday night. So I need to really, you know, very forcefully address this though we can't actually, because of Scouts, you can't proselytize to the kids at the time. But there's no reason that my son or another member of the church can't get up and say, by the way, there's a youth group meeting at this time. Anybody who wants to come. And we always let them know about these other events. So you do meet some oppositional along the way.
I'm afraid that our time is up. So thank you very much for coming, and we'll be around another week for a conversation.
Thank you.